Hey everybody, welcome to a special edition of the Front Stretch Podcast. I'm your host, Dustin Albino. And as always, Mike Neff is here with me.
Hello!
But also we've got owner of FrontStretch.com, Tom Bowles. And we got Mike Massey, my colleague.
Hello.
Now guys, a lot has happened in Speed Week so far. Some good, some bad. I don't know where you guys want to start. Should we start with the trucks? I mean, that's been the highlight so far.
There hasn't been a whole lot of good, so we might as well start with the trucks because that was good. At least in my opinion, it was. While in Crazy Race, you had 11 caution flags, set a new record. Only 9 trucks finished the race, another record for Daytona. So it was like a really crazy race, but certainly at the end of the day, it was the best racing that we've seen all Speed Weeks. And the first time we've actually seen cars or trucks go side by side for an extended period of time. And Austin Hill definitely completed kind of a storybook for him, you know, winning his first race out with a championship team from last year, you know, Hattori Racing Enterprises. They got to be really proud of where they're at, taking a guy that only had one top five finish in 51 Truck Series starts and wheeling him to victory lane.
And Neff, you've been coming down to Speed Weeks for a long time, and the trucks usually put on a show. This year, the drafting was, you know, the side drafting and the drafting was great. Way better than the Cup Series so far in the duels or the Clash. And the Xfinity race, which we'll talk about, I guess, the trucks was put on a show compared to the other two series.
Are you calling me old?
No.
It sounded like you're calling me old, saying I've been down here a lot of times.
You bring experience to the podcast.
There you go. I agree. I mean, at least the trucks tried. I give them credit. Guys were trying to make moves. Guys pitted early on the stages so that they could gain track position and try to make the race on one stop. People pulled out of line, and other guys tried to get down behind them. I mean, there were guys attempting to make things happen. Whether it worked or didn't work, they were at least going for it. In the end, it tore up a lot of trucks.
Yeah.
I was actually just trying to look and see how many laps we ran under caution, because I think somewhere close to half the laps of the race were under caution. But at least they tried. As far as the duels went and the Xfinity race, nobody tried anything in either of those. So I was glad that they attempted to put on a show. You hate to see that many vehicles getting torn up, but the alternative was way more boring.
And, Massey, what are your thoughts? Because we had drivers finish in the top five, like Austin Hill, who won the race. Spencer Boyd finished fourth. So many, you know, the who's who up front.
Well, the thing about it is I think the truckers showed that those drivers have that hunger to win.
Yep.
And I feel like that hunger's lacking in the Xfinity Series and the Cup Series. They're just content with a good finish. But all those truck drivers wanted to win and felt they had a shot at winning. And I talked to Angela Ruck after the race,
oh, yeah,
who finished her career best 8th. And she thought she had a shot at winning the race. She thought she had a truck that could win the race. And that just shows that even all those guys up there, Spencer Boyd, any of them, had a shot to win, given... And they might have gotten a little too aggressive, and that's why we only had 9 trucks finish, but...
But it was a good race.
Yeah.
Yes.
I was wrong, just for those of you that know. The race was 111 laps because we went into triple overtime.
Longest truck race in the history, yeah. 277.5 miles.
And there were 55 caution laps. So thanks to us going into overtime, there was one more green flag lap than caution lap.
Wow.
56 green flag laps, 55 caution laps.
I wanted to mention something about incentive because I think it ties everything up and allows us to move forward a little bit. I think that's really been a topic of Speed Weeks, right? Massey just hit on it. All the truck drivers felt like they had a shot to win and they had incentive to win. You look at the Xfinity Series where it's a little bit of a weaker field this year where you almost feel like the playoff drivers in some ways are already set and you had a real struggle with getting the second groove worked in. Was there incentive for the drivers to get a better finish if they were in the top 5, in the top 10, comfortable? And as we heard from several Xfinity drivers after the race, they know what the other side of this is like. Trip to the care center, maybe flipping upside down, maybe a big one. You look at the duels and the cup side, same type of thing. They all, for the most part, with a few exceptions, obviously there was a real exciting battle to get Parker Kligerman into the field over Ryan Truex, but everybody's already in the race. Does it really matter if you start 20th or 30th? And I wonder if there wasn't enough incentive. And as NASCAR looks at tweaking rules and trying to really fix the product, you know, in 2020, 2021, and they're saying all the ideas are on the table, I wonder if incentive really showed its head here so far during Speed Weeks.
Yeah, and I think that's when we bring up the Xfinity series, because, guys, I'm a big fan of the Xfinity series, but this is probably the worst Xfinity race I've ever watched. It was awful. Single-file racing, literally the entire race, and you know, until the final laps of each stage, really, where guys are trying to make a move. But by then, it's too late. You can't come from fifth or sixth and get a run. So, Neff, I guess I'll throw it to you. We had Michael in that win. I mean, I guess that's a story.
Yeah, I think it's kind of a cool story, actually. Michael's taking a real beating. Let's face it, he's, if not the face of it, close to the face of Rent-A-Ride. I know he at least has some experience in late models and lower-tier racing before he got to the upper levels. There's a lot of people that don't realize Paul Menard ran a lot of late model races before he ever got up to the upper levels and actually won in those levels. So you've had a lot of people bashing Michael for a while, and rightfully so. I mean, he's in arguably the best or close to the best equipment in the Xfinity series, and it's only because he's bringing sponsorship that happens to be family money. But Dale Jr. talked about it in the post-race press conference, that the Michael Annette that they have now is nowhere near the one that they hired initially, and that he has come a long way and has finally accepted the fact that he can run up front. And he drove the end of that race for the final 45 laps from the front. He didn't get a lot of challenge, but anything that was thrown his way, he answered. So it's a long way from saying he's a championship contender, but it was at least a little bit of justification for him to finally win a race and you know, at least show that he isn't a back marker or a field filler.
Now, granted, it was his first win in, you know, we obviously don't know Michael the way Dale Jr. knows Michael, with working with him every single day. But Massey, I guess I'll throw this to you. How much do you buy that? Because last year, didn't get a single top five, three top tens the entire year, and missed the playoffs in junior motorsports equipment.
Well, I think that Michael Annette's not going to turn into a championship caliber driver just because of this one performance.
Yeah, one race.
The thing that impresses me about this race is Travis Mack. I think last year he got in a bad situation with that 95 team, and they just didn't work out for some reason or another. He's getting a second chance with Michael Annette's team, and he's proven that he could be a pretty good crew chief. And, you know, when it comes to Speed Weeks, a lot of it has to do with the horsepower underneath and the setup of the car. The driver doesn't play as big of a role in, you know, driving fast laps around Daytona. So I think that Travis Mack just had a really impressive weekend, and Michael Annette was his conduit.
You mentioned something about buying it, and I think it's really important going forward in seeing the fan reaction to two wins with two drivers in Austin Hill and Michael Annette, where all the backstory was they've worked really hard in the offseason, they've tried really hard, and they've gotten better. And that's probably true. They both have put in all this additional effort, in Annette's case because he missed the playoffs, in Austin's case because he was stepping into a championship caliber ride. But will the fans buy that effort and look at the positive? Or will they sit there, as we saw on Twitter and on social media a little bit, after these races going, these guys bought themselves wins. They're not real athletes. They bought themselves the money that they needed to actually go out and win the race. I don't want to deal with this. And which side they fall on will really be telling in terms of whether the fan base continues to erode or whether it can at least hang tight through these restrictor plate races where you can get these types of situations that happen.
Yeah, and for Annette, I mean, he didn't hide away from the past results last year, and he's mentioned it to me in an interview how he underperformed all of last year and the year before. I don't know. One race definitely doesn't turn it around, but it is a good start. We had a lot, you know, not good racing at all just throughout. I was really disappointed. It looked just like the duels did, except the duels were 260-lap races, and this was just a 120-lap race. I mean, in my opinion. I don't know what your guys' take is.
Yeah, and it bothered me a little bit that some guys didn't take a chance.
Right.
I understand if you think you have a legitimate shot at running for a title and you're worried that maybe a win won't come and you have a chance to point your way in, so let's go for a maximum point day. But if you're running a one-off race for somebody, or if you're a cup interloper, or if you're somebody that knows you run at the back of the pack every week and the only shot you have to win is a plate race, why are you not pulling down out of line and tucking in behind Chase Elliott and seeing if you can get enough momentum to push him to the front? Because Elliott was gaining some ground on that line by himself, that if he could have got four or five guys lined up and really committed to it for 15 or 20 laps, I think they legitimately could have brought a second line into it. And once that second line starts to get close to the front, more people participate, all of a sudden you've got a race. And I just... it was just really disappointing that you had one or two guys make half-hearted efforts at joining Elliott and everybody else was content to just ride at the top. I do give Tyler Reddick a little bit of credit. He dove down under some guys and muscled his way up in line and passed, I don't know, seven or eight cars, which if we look at the loop statistics, that's probably the most cars that anybody passed all day.
Do you guys have any final thoughts on the Xfinity Series? Because I feel like this is a could be a good transition point.
I will say this race today was so boring and so uneventful that it made me miss the mile and a half races where Kyle Busch laps the field. Because at least he's passing people.
That's a good point. Now, this is a good transition point because the only cup action we've seen all of Speed Weeks, the Clash and the two duels, were also single file. So this race was 120 laps today, being Saturday for the Xfinity race. Tomorrow's 200 laps. We saw that 38 cars can run single file today. Will it happen tomorrow?
God, I hope not. I don't know, 3 or 4 years ago, we had a weekend like this where the duels were really boring. The Clash was extremely boring. Trucks and Xfinity were okay, but they weren't great. They dropped the green flag on the 500, and for the first 110 laps, it was three wide, like nine rows deep. I mean, it was unbelievable.
Yep.
And it came out of the blue. There was really no indication that that was going to be the case. But, man, it was a whale of a race. So media is not going to be in the driver's meeting in the morning, but we'll see it broadcast on ISM Vision, which anybody who's got a ticket to the race, come out early and you can actually watch the driver meeting. But I hope at some point during that meeting, there's a sun flare or a black hole moves over or something, and we get static for about 5 minutes. And during that 5 minutes, Steve O'Donnell gets up there and reads these guys a riot act about the fact that this is entertainment and nobody's paying $100 and some a ticket to watch a parade around the top of this track. So somebody's got to get a fire lit under these drivers. I hope it happens tomorrow and we see a whale of a race.
Very good points, guys. Tom, you got anything to add to that?
I think that incentive, like we talked about earlier, is going to play a factor tomorrow. And you look at the front row and you look at Hendrick Motorsports. I think one of the storylines that hasn't been talked about enough is the front row sweep for the 500, where you have William Byron, who at 21 years old, one of the youngest pole sitters in 500 history, and then Alex Bowman on the front row for the second straight year. You have Jimmy Johnson, who's already won a race. I know we'll get into contact with other drivers later, but bottom line, he did win the Clash. First time he's been in victory lane since Dover almost 2 years ago. So you have this Hendrick team that feels reinvigorated. They've also, in the duels, shown that they can pass on the inside by themselves, very similar to how Joey Logano won his duel race. So they have something to prove, and they want to stay out front, and they want to showcase that Chevy's bad year is over in 2019. So you have that, you have the prestige of the big race of the Daytona 500, and you have a lot of guys that are hungry. There are still some big names in this field that have never won the 500. Brad Keselowski, Kyle Busch, Clint Bowyer, who was really strong in his duel. Those names come to mind as guys that really want this trophy. So I think that's going to lead to a more aggressive 500 tomorrow and a much better race. I hope I'm wrong, but we'll just have to wait and see. Well, I'm sorry. I hope I'm right. Yeah, exactly.
Massey, what are you thinking? Because, as we've mentioned, the racing hasn't been great this week, but something's got to turn.
Well, it's still the Daytona 500.
Yep.
It's still the most important race on the schedule. It's still the one there. If you win it, it'll be announced along with your name long after you've won
it. You're a champion.
I mean, Michael Waldrop's made a whole career at Fox just based on winning two of them. So I think that will come out in those drivers. They'll want that attached to their name. They'll drive a little bit harder. They haven't really raced for anything in the Clash, in the duels. but they have a chance to get their name on that trophy and a chance to punch their ticket for the playoffs.
All right, you're right. That's a good point. You know, we've never had over 16 winners in the regular season, so whoever wins them all is in the playoffs. Speaking of winners, guys, Kevin Harvick and Joey Logano each won their respective duel on Thursday night. Harvick looked really good. Logano made a last-lap pass from fourth all the way up to the lead. So we did see that it can be done if you make a move at the right time. Logano got his done on the front stretch going into turn one, making the pass through the middles of turn one and two. I mean, what do you think from Harvick and Logano? Because I think Logano is obviously one of the favorites.
Yeah, I think when we saw Logano in the clash even, he pulled out a line and was able to make moves and gain on cars by himself. And we've seen that in years past with Brad Keselowski, who, for whatever reason, always seems to have something bite him. Today, the top of his car flopped off, which so I thought it was a cool reference that he brought back to racing convertibles at the beach. But it's one of those things that Logano has a strong car for sure. We saw Ryan Blaney last year, although he hasn't shown the muscle quite as much this time around. The Ford seemed to be the cars to beat, and I think if they work together and plot it out right, I think you'll see Harvick and Logano both being up there. Logano tends to be pretty loyal to his Penske teammates, so that's where I think Harvick might be the odd man out if he doesn't have some of his buddies up there. But Clint Bowyer's right close behind. So when it's all said and done, unless the Hendrick teams have their handling figured out, because we've seen this in the past, they all qualify up front, get in a race and wreck. So if they've got their handling figured out to where they've still got speed, it could be a different story. But right now, I think you could have a battle of two organizations with Penske going up against Stewart Haas to see who wins.
And it's ironic that you say that, because what do those two have in common? They're both Fords. And so on Friday, I was in the garage area, and about 15 minutes into I guess it was the second practice, all seven of those cars went out at the same time. They all rolled. They all started their engine at the same time in the garage area in their stall. So, I mean, it looks like it could be, you know, Penske versus Stewart Haas. As we saw last year, it's tough to beat those four Stewart Haas cars when they tanned them up like they did at Talladega.
Again, beating on my central theme, right? And Massey, I'll hand this over to you. The teamwork that we're seeing, we've never seen this
right
to this level in plate racing. I think that what we saw last fall at Talladega with Stewart Haas Racing running 1, 2, 3, 4, that changed the game. And I think one of the keys to the 500 is, will these packs be able to break up these team cars so that you have different people working together in different ways? Or, especially in the first stage, is Ford going to come out in that way, try and team up in their packs of three and four cars, you know, based on who's with who, and just run single file and try and get away? You know, would Hendrick try and do that if they were able to get their four cars hooked up? And I think that also changes the level of incentive and aggression, because if you're running second to your teammate, are you really going to pass them in stage one when the risk is not there? There's just not enough reward to do it?
Well, one thing about it, I think that Hendrick Motorsports hasn't played all their cards yet. William Byron and Alex Bowman had nothing to race for in the duels. The only thing they had to race for was to not crash. That left Jimmy Johnson by himself for the second half of the race, so he couldn't make it. Well, won the clash already.
We saw what happened there, though.
We did.
And can't leave him alone.
Yeah. And then Chase Elliott was trying to make moves in the clash. He has a good car and was doing it by himself, but he needed that teammate to just give him that little extra push. So I think once those four get synced together, they could rival Stewart Haas Racing and Team Penske.
Yeah, so before we get into picks and dark horses, guys, I want to ask you guys about Jimmy Johnson. Because Neff and I talked about on the podcast this week, which came out Thursday, he, in the clash, he didn't, I don't know, Neff thought he wrecked Menard. I thought he wrecked Menard. And on Thursday night in the duel, he wrecked Kyle Busch. So, I mean, are we going to go 3 for 3?
I think we may go more than that. I think you may see it happen 2 or 3 times in the 500.
What's going on?
I've known it, I've observed it for a long time. I know people that are diehard Jimmy Johnson fans that will tell you the same thing. He is not a good plate racer. Never has been, from what we've seen this weekend, probably never going to be. So it's a matter of, I don't picture him caring because however you want to look at this breakup or split of he and Chad, Jimmy is out to prove a point that he can win without Chad. And I promise you, Chad is out to prove a point that he can win without Jimmy. And it's a new fire in Jimmy Johnson that we haven't seen for 2 or 3 years. I'll never say that he didn't have a determination and a grit that is above most other guys that are competing in this sport. But it's back up to championship level Jimmy. I don't know if his talent matches it. And we'll find that out as the year goes along. But he is absolutely going to be making some aggressive moves on Sunday. How many cars it tears up, we could make a drinking game out of that.
Yeah, and I talked to him after the duel, and he still believed firmly that the clash was a racing deal, but he owned up to this one.
I do think that with Jimmy, Mike makes some really good points about how he's out to prove himself in this era without Chad and after a year in which he didn't win a race. And I think he came out in the clash. He was very aggressive. I think he's going to be that way for the first few races of the year. I think they have a little bit of a chip on their shoulders, both he and the new crew chief, Kevin Mendiering. But I listened to Ricky Craven, who I really have a lot of respect for, and I think he's one of the best analysts. And he was talking about, as he got older in his career, he lost some peripheral vision, and he was wondering if that was the case with Johnson. And it made me think that sometimes, while that might be true, we may overanalyze these things. These may be two cases that, as crazy as it is, may just be purely coincidental. You have a case in the clash where Johnson was getting really aggressive. He hadn't won in so long. The rain was coming, and it was a race and deal. And then you have a literal mistake in the duel where he just made a mistake. And I don't remember Jimmy wrecking people in the last plate race, and certainly he has a history of making mistakes in plate tracks, but I don't think he suddenly, you know, doesn't have the right vision, is going to wreck everyone in every plate race, and we have to worry that he's going to be a battering ram in the Daytona 500. This guy won 7 championships.
Right.
So I almost feel like the lack of storylines this week have pushed this to be bigger than it actually should be. And at the end of the day, Jimmy's going to do just fine in the 500, but you better watch out for Kyle.
But he did poke the bear in Kyle Busch, Massey.
Yeah, we could see, if that happens again on Sunday, we could see Cale Yarbrough versus the Allisons all over again, but this time it's the Busch brothers and Jimmy Johnson. I mean, Kyle Busch is an enemy you do not want to create, and not only that, I don't think Paul Menard is that much of an enemy. I mean, we've never seen him act out or anything, but he seems like this tough guy from the woods or something that could just, you know, kick your butt if he needed to. So Jimmy's got to watch out who he's messing with out there.
You don't mess with the quiet guy.
Yeah, it's always the quiet ones.
I did not even think about the Busch brother angle. That would be phenomenal.
40th anniversary,
too. Kurt and Jimmy, like, wrecking down a backstretch. Kyle pulls up alongside, jumps out, and the next thing you know, we're hearing Mike Joy go, and there's a fight! And they end up rolling around on a backstretch. That would be unbelievable. That would be a cool anniversary.
Although Dustin and I saw the Busch brothers driver intros come in, what, pretty much right next to each other, and it's like they weren't even acknowledging each other as they were coming in. Did you notice that, Dustin? I guess they have a weird relationship sometimes.
I do think they have a weird relationship. I can't speak on that personally, but yeah, I mean, you're right. I mean, I didn't really acknowledge as much as you did, but who knows? Who knows what we'll see tomorrow? But moving on, guys, I want your dark horses before we get to the picks, because anyone can win this race. I mean, literally. It's a plate race. We've seen, like, Trevor Bayne win it just 8 years ago. Can't believe it's already been 8 years. So who's your dark horses?
Matty D. I think Matt Benedetto had a truly legitimate shot to win this race last year. I mean, he was in the top 5 or 6 as the laps were winding down and got taken out. And I think he's in a better vehicle this year than he was last year. So my vote's on De Benedetto.
Master, who you got?
Well, my question is, does Paul Menard count as a dark horse?
No.
He's in Penske Equipment, but he's only won one race. So, I mean, depends on how you view it.
If he counts, then he'd be my dark horse. And it'd be so special just because Glenn Wood just passed away. And it'd be the 100th win for the Wood brothers. It'd be a really popular win.
Tom?
Mike stole my long shot in Matt E.D., but there's somebody else I've been crowing about all week that I'm not as high on after the Xfinity race today, but Tyler Reddick. He's in this race with nothing to lose. One race deal, sponsorship from Simbacore. driving for Richard Childress Racing team that has had a lot of success in plate races. His teammate just so happens to be last year's Daytona 500 winner in Austin Dillon. He's also got another teammate, rookie Daniel Hemric. And I don't really feel like he has anything to lose. And he's surprised at this racetrack before. See Daytona Xfinity race last year. So I definitely think he's the type of guy that, especially if he's up in the lead pack late, somebody that won't be sitting there single file not trying to get the job done. He's going to try and go for it.
Yeah, and like I mentioned earlier, he made some really nice moves today in that Xfinity race when nobody else was making moves, where he dove under guys and maybe there was a hole there, maybe there wasn't, and he just wedged himself right back up into it and made some passes. I did look up on the loop statistics, which I still don't fully understand, but Chase Elliott had the most meaningful passes at 103. Reddick was fourth on the list with 76 meaningful passes.
Interesting. Well, my dark horse, I'm going to go JTG. You could pick either one of them. I'm going to go Chris Buescher. Three career top tens at Daytona. He has obviously limited experience. And then two top fives last year, a pair of fifth place finishes. And also, he ran pretty well in the duel. I think he finished eighth. So I wouldn't be surprised. And they're going all hands on deck this year with their new sponsorship package and the format that they're doing. So we'll get to our picks now, Neff. Who you got?
I'm going to keep riding the pony. I know where he's going. I was on Eric Almirola all last year, and I was a mile from being right and looking like a genius. So I'm going to stick with it and say that Eric Almirola, after a year, gets redemption, and wouldn't it be fitting if he dumped Austin Dillon to do it?
And this that would be funny. But this weekend's kind of been the story of redemption. So who do you got?
Well, I'm between two guys on this. It's based solely on the fact that they have such remarkable careers and no Daytona 500. And that's Kyle Busch and Brad Keselowski. Uh-huh. I think I'm going to go with Kyle Busch just because we haven't heard anything from him all week, but he's still that guy that can just pop out of nowhere and win a race.
And Tom and I saw him going into the driver introductions on Thursday. He looked really, really focused.
Yeah, he's been focused all week. He's been raging mad ever since the whole Johnson incident. I think he'll definitely be heard from on Sunday. And to Massey's point about Keselowski, he was actually my pick initially in the beginning of the week. I actually did some radio hits and made it clear that I was picking him, but I changed my mind. Hmm. And I changed my mind after today because it just doesn't seem like luck is on his side. He just had a weird penalty in the duel where NASCAR nailed him for pitting outside the box, where it didn't really feel like he pit outside the box. And then today, with the whole escape hatch thing, it ruined his race. So even though he's the favorite in a lot of gambling circles, I've seen him as a favorite in a lot of Vegas sports betting areas, I'm going to go with Kevin Harvick.
Hmm.
Harvick quietly won the duel on Thursday. He's come in and had one of the fastest cars in the last several plate races. He's also had no top 10 finishes in the last five Daytona races, which means to me, he's finally due to have luck come to his side. And I think there's no better way to start off, you know, another push for the championship four than to lock that playoff spot down. Very, very important this year with the new handling package. You want to not worry about the playoffs by March so you can spend the next couple months fiddling around and finding what works for the races that really matter.
And to go off you, Tom, I saw Rodney Childress say the other night that was the dual win was the first of his career. Obviously, Kevin Harvick's won the Daytona 500, but you know that he wants to get one for Rodney Childress. That would be special since they have such a tight bond.
Now, Kevin Harvick won his Daytona 500 in the Shell Pennzoil paint scheme, so I'm going with Joey Logano in the Shell Pennzoil paint scheme. Former Daytona 500 champion as well. Also quietly won his duel on Thursday night with the last lap pass. Very, very good at restrictor plates. He's won, what, three or four races at Talladega, once at Daytona. Obviously, the duel the other night. So I'm going Joey Logano. I think Ford's going to be the standard. It's going to be very hard to beat the new Mustang. Just like last year, the Camaro got in victory in their first race. I say the Mustang gets in this year in their first race. Guys, we've gone almost a half hour. Any final thoughts before we sign off?
I feel like, I mean, again, we don't know what's going to happen out of this deal, but you mentioned it earlier that we have never had more than 16 winners, and so that would probably lock a winner into the playoffs. This year, with this package, that may not be the case. When we're true. Going to racetracks with basically restricted engines, there's a real chance that we could see 18 or 19 winners going into the playoffs. And I think you need to step up the game and win anytime you have a chance. So it's going to be interesting to see if that sense of urgency plays out when they drop the green flag on Sunday.
Or there could be like 5 or 6.
Or there could be 5 or 6.
It's worth noting that also that this is the last restricted paint race at Daytona. They'll go to the tapered spacer, which is still a restrictor play.
A thicker, funnier shaped restrictor play.
But they're going to have 100 more horsepower the next time they come to Daytona or when they go to Talladega this year. So whether you loved or hated the era, it's still the end of an era. And just enjoy it.
And they'll have throttle response, which is a nice thing.
Yeah. 30 years of restrictor play. I thought that the one good story surrounding the duels was the whole story surrounding Parker Kligerman and getting into the 500 field. There was some manufactured teamwork there that I think doesn't play well long-term with the fans. I think it's a little too Formula One-ish, but at the same time, I think Parker's story is a good one. He had said afterwards he never thought he was going to even make the 500 again as a full-time pit reporter for NBC. And now he's there, and he's excited about the race. And you know, I think it's good for NASCAR that a team like the Gaunt brothers, who's trying to build their program up the right way, they're only going to do 12 races this year, has a shot just like everybody else.
Yeah, and I'll leave you guys with this stat. 18 of 40 drivers in this Daytona 500 have never won a cup race. And 27 of the 40 have won 3 or less. So there's a very good chance that we see a new guy get into victory lane this weekend.
Yeah. A real legitimate shot. And I did want to say one more thing. Mr. Massey just pointed out or gave me a reminder that Sam Bass passed away this morning and or tomorrow by the time you hear this podcast, or yesterday. My whole time is all messed up. I've had the pleasure to talk to Sam a myriad of times, and a thing that I don't think a lot of people realize, he kind of got pushed out of the sport as his years went on, simply because of technology and the fact that organizations look to cut money, and so they brought in people with graphic arts abilities and started doing all their car design in-house. But the thing that nobody, I don't think, realized was the attention to detail that Sam had. And if you ever had the pleasure of going on a tour of his shop, he had a slot car track in his studio. And if he was coming up with an idea for a car scheme, he would actually paint up a slot car and run it on the track and take pictures of it at speed so that he knew when photographers took pictures and fans took pictures that the car would still look good. And he had an entire drawer full of really cool looking car paint schemes that never saw the light of day because when he put them on his little slot car track, they looked like garbage. And he was a real boon and benefactor to the whole sport. And there's a lot of drivers that owe a lot of money to Sam Bass because he made them a ton of money in merchandise sales with his car designs. And I feel honored that I got to know the man pretty well. I hate that one of my kidneys was not a match so that I could have given it to him to hopefully have him around a little bit longer. But we're all better for having him had been here, and we're all worse off now that he's gone.
Yeah, I don't think we can top that. I think Neff speaks, you know, on behalf of the whole staff here at Front Stretch. Definitely rest in peace, Sam Bass. He's done a lot for the sport, as Neff said. But I guess until then, we're going to hopefully see a great Daytona 500 tomorrow. But until later this week, where Neff and I will be again on the podcast, hopefully with Zach Cantore this week, we have.
Peace out.